Our Lord Jesus, in Luke chapter 16, verse 8, made an observation that I am afraid is only too frequently true. The children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. The story of Festus, the noble Roman governor in Judea in the days of the Apostle Paul, perhaps well illustrates this principle, because some of the points that Festus uses in his arguments in the trial of Paul show some of the most noble recognition of true justice and the things that we should all recognize in arguments one with another. Our discussion this morning is going to be broken into four phases. First, we wanted to get an overview of the whole trial process that the Apostle Paul went through at the end of his ministry. Second, we want to analyze the case against Paul and his defense to the charges. Third, we want to analyze the cast of characters that are involved in the trial of Paul. And then fourth, we want to notice the principles of justice that Festus recognizes and uses in the trial process. The trial of the Apostle Paul on charges of heresy occupy one of the larger single segments of the Bible. Over 20% of the book of Acts is devoted to the trial of Paul. All of chapters 21 through 26 of the book of Acts are devoted to this one incident. We're going to give a brief chronological synopsis so we can see the flow of events that take place. In chapter 21, verses 17 to 19, the Apostle Paul arrives in Jerusalem from his last missionary journey, and immediately he meets with James and the other apostles that are there. In chapter 21, verses 20 to 26, he purifies himself in the temple, as was customary for the Jews, along with four others who had recently taken a vow, and it was customary for those who had taken a vow. In chapter 21, verses 27 to 31, we find that the Jews mistakenly assume that these four who were accompanying Paul into the temple, or at least some of these four, were Gentiles, Greeks. And as a result, they start a riot against the apostle. The result of that riot is given in verses 32 to 39, where Paul is taken into, under arrest, but into protective custody by the Roman soldiers to protect him from the crowds around him. In chapter 21, verse 40, through chapter 22, verse 21, we find the first defense of Paul. And this is a defense that he makes before the Hebrew crowds that have assembled on this occasion. In chapter 22, verses 22 and 23, these crowds in turn again start a second rebellion, second riot against Paul. Chapter 22, 24 to 29, the Romans threaten to scourge Paul, but Paul avoids this by making his first claim of Roman citizenship, and therefore he is not eligible to being scourged. Chapter 22, verse 30 through chapter 23, verse 11, is the first formal trial that Paul has, and this is before the Jewish court, before the Sanhedrin. Following this trial, in chapter 23, verses 12 to 35, we find a plot by the Jews who are unsuccessful in the trial to condemn Paul. They have a plot to kill him. When this plot is foiled, he is then remanded to Felix, who is the present governor of Rome in Judea, again for the purpose of protective custody and an objective hearing of the charges against him. Most of chapter 24, verses 1 to 26, deal with the second trial of Paul, the first one before the Romans, the trial before Felix, and his defense to Felix. The last verse of that chapter, we find a change of venue caused by the fact that Felix is removed as the governor of Judea and replaced by Festus. In chapter 25, the first five verses, we find that once Festus gets in office, immediately the Jews press that Paul have a trial in Jerusalem, again under the Jewish court, under the Sanhedrin, where they feel they have more control. Chapter 25, verses 6 to 12, Festus refuses that. He brings Paul to Caesarea, and the Jews are forced to present their case before the Roman court, the court of Festus. Chapter 25, verses 13 to 27, Festus, having finished his investigation, solicits the aid of King Agrippa, who had come to Caesarea to honor Festus upon his assumption of the office of governor, and we have the trial before Agrippa. And then following that, after Agrippa hears the case, in chapter 26, we find Paul's journey to Rome for his final, as we would say, appeal to the Supreme Court, when he goes up to the highest tribunal of the Roman Empire. So that briefly is the overall outline of the experiences that Paul goes through. In other words, there are five distinct hearings of Paul, four trials. There was the hearing before the Jewish people when they were still in the mob attitude, rebelliousness. This was followed by a formal trial before the Sanhedrin, then a formal trial before the Roman governor Felix, then a trial before the Roman governor Festus, and in the middle of that trial, the soliciting and another hearing of the matter before King Agrippa, and finally the remanding to Rome. With that overview, let's get a clear understanding of the case against Paul, and then a case of the characters. The case against Paul was very clear. There was no question what the charges were. They were outlined in a list of four specific charges in chapter 21, verse 26, 28. Crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man, first, that teacheth all men everywhere against the people," against the Jews. "Second, and against the law. Third, and against this place, the temple. And fourth, and further, has brought Greeks into the temple and polluted the holy place." To summarize it very quickly, what the charges were was heresy. Heresy by teaching, heresy by action in bringing Greeks into the temple compound. Now, verse 29 gives you a little parenthesis showing, from an objective, factual standpoint, the last charge was incorrect. They had seen before with him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, who they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. In other words, it was their supposition that one of the four that they had heard of in the temple was Trophimus, who should not be in the temple because he was not a Jew, but was a Greek. In Paul's defense before the people, he gives a very logical defense. Paul states the historical background of his conversion from traditional Judaism to what at that time was known as a sect of Judaism called Christianity. He said, "I'm still a Jew, but I'm a Jew of the Christian sect." At that time, until the troubles of AD 70, the Christians were not noted as being non-Jewish. They were still Jewish, but of a different sect or division of the Jewish religion. And this is Paul's defense. And he proceeds in this defense all the way until he comes to the light on the way to Damascus, his conversion experience, and then in listing the conversion experience, he mentions one thing that throws that crowd into a complete uproar, into a complete riot. In chapter 22, verses 22 and 23, starting in verse 21, "And he said unto me," this was the voice, "Depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles." And when the audience, they gave him audience until this word, until he said he had been sent to the Gentiles, then they lifted up their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth. It is not fit that he should live." and as he cried out, he cast off the clothes and threw dust in the air, and a general riot ensued. So Paul does not even get to finish his first defense. As soon as he mentions that he has a commission to go to the Gentiles, immediately the Jews stop him. Now this is in the presence of the Roman soldiers who are Gentiles. So they felt sufficiently safe within their own precincts to cause this uproar and riot. In the second hearing, which was the hearing before the Sanhedrin, Paul changes his defense. His first defense was historical account of his conversion. Now, in the second defense, he notices in the body of the Sanhedrin before him that there are both Sadducees and Pharisees. And he capitalizes on that in building his second defense. Because in the Jews, in these two parties, there were two basic beliefs. The one group had no real faith in the scriptures. They did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. And so they were sad, you see. There was no Sadducee party. The other party had a strong belief in the resurrection of the dead. But they were very self-righteous. They were fair, I see. These were the Pharisees. And these were the two parties he saw. So Paul, capitalizing on this, uses this difference and said, I belong to the party that believes in the resurrection of the dead. And his entire defense is based upon, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now, he wasn't charged with not believing that. That wasn't part of the accusation. The accusation was you taught heresy against the Jews, against the temple, against the law. And further, your actions show this heresy by bringing Greeks into the temple. Paul ignores all of that in his defense and only argues, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Almost changing the whole course of the events. The next tribunal is unable to convict him. And he is brought into Caesarea, the Roman garrison city. He goes through his first trial before the Gentiles. This is before Felix. Now, in Paul's defense before Felix, he again makes a minor change. He sort of incorporates both arguments. The first part of Paul's defense before Felix is he denies the charges that are against him. He doesn't deny them individually. He denies them categorically. He denies the principle upon which the trial was conducted. Chapter 24, verse 13. Neither can they prove the things wherefore they now accuse me. They're just making charges. We have no proof for their charges. Again in verse 18. Whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. They've accused me of causing a riot. I came in there quietly. They caused the riot. So Paul's first part is just saying, but the charges ain't true. I'm innocent of the charges. But he does not give a true legal defense. He merely states, not guilty. Then he takes off again on the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. Now this is not before a Jewish audience. This is before the Gentile. Before Felix. Chapter 23, verse 15, I have hoped toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. In verse 21, it says, they've got no charge against me, except to be for this one voice, that I cried among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, for this I am called in question this day. And that wasn't really true. Paul wasn't really called in question for the resurrection of the dead. He was called in question for his sympathy toward the Gentiles. Even his charges of heresy were based on his sympathy toward the Gentiles. How did he preach against the Jews? Not by preaching the resurrection of the dead. The Pharisees would never agree that that was against the Jews. But they said, you're teaching that God is opening the way to take in Gentiles without circumcision is teaching against the Jewish people. He's teaching against the law because he said the law was replaced by Christ. Nothing about the resurrection of the dead. He taught against the temple because he was saying that to them, in their minds, he was saying the temple is open to both Jews and Gentiles. The middle wall partition is broken down. No longer is there a court of the Gentiles and a court of the Jews. And he has brought Gentiles into the temple, which he had not. But these will be four charges, no charge about the resurrection. But Paul's defense is, I believe in the resurrection. That's the question I'm calling today. An odd response. Paul's fourth defense, his defense before Festus, rests upon two points also. Chapter 25, verse 8, a claim of innocence. He answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor even against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. That is Paul's only direct statement in the entire trial that relates to the original charges. And all he says is, not true. I didn't do this. Then he immediately proceeds to talk about the resurrection of the dead. Verses 9 to 11 of chapter 25. Got the wrong verses there. No, he does not get into the resurrection in this answer. He refuses to be judged at Jerusalem. He says, I am not going to be judged at Jerusalem. I'm a Roman citizen. I should be judged before Caesar. That's the other part of his defense. Then King Agrippa comes, hears him on the last charge. Once again, he goes into the historical background of his conversion, but he emphasizes, first of all, Christ's resurrection. Secondly, the commission that Paul received at the hand of the risen Christ to preach to the Gentiles. That's his defense. I think the key verse in the entire defense of Paul is in chapter 26, verse 19. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision. If you think about it, as we get into a little analysis of the trial, we'll notice that that is what he's resting his entire case on. I had a vision. Now let's summarize and look at analysis of this. The charge was clear. He was undercharged by the Jewish people for heresy by teaching and heresy by example in bringing non-Jews into the temple area. Paul's main defense in the whole of the trial is, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. An answer which even half of his accusers, the Pharisees, believed him. How do these two relate? How does Paul's relationship with his belief in the resurrection of the dead relate to the charge, which was a charge that you were talking heresy by preaching to the Gentiles? Basically this way. Paul said, I am not actively spreading heresy. I am preaching to the Gentiles. That's true. But I'm preaching to the Gentiles for one basic reason. Because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now, you believe in the resurrection of the dead. I saw a dead man resurrected. I saw Jesus of Nazareth after he was dead. Because I believe in the resurrection, I believe in what I saw. And I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. In other words, his simple answer was, I have one reason for preaching to the Gentiles. A dead man told me to do so. A man that you said was dead. Now, many of you agree that the dead can be raised. So it should not be surprising I saw a dead man. You believe in that. This dead man said, go to the Gentiles. What would you do if a dead man told you to go to the Gentiles? Well, you would say, if I saw that dead man, he must be a good man to not be dead anymore. And therefore, I would do what he said. This is the theological basis. It's a very clever approach to the Jewish people. Totally incomprehensible to the Roman mind. But to the Jewish mind, it was a good defense. And yet, 3 out of 5 of Paul's defenses were before the Gentiles. And he uses this. Understanding then the crime, he was a charge of understanding his defense. That his defense was, I had a heavenly vision, and because of this, I preached to the Gentiles. Let's look at the cast of characters. The Sanhedrin, the first formal court that he was put before, was composed of 70 of the top recognized Jewish people by their own reckoning. They had one commission, and their commission was to preserve the purity of the Jewish religion. In doing this, they were extremely prejudiced, and rather than act the role of a jury, they took on more of the role of a prosecuting attorney. They really became the ones pressing the charges instead of the ones who were hearing the charges as to whether they were true or false. And you have Felix. Even history agrees that Felix was one of the most tyrannical of all Roman governors. That Felix was in his office as much for the money as for the justice of the case. And to this the scriptures bear witness, because in chapter 24, verse 26, we find his open asking of Paul for a bribe. He hoped that money should have been given him of Paul that he might lose some. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. He kept pressing his case. He was before a very corrupt judge. But Felix had one advantage, in that Felix, unlike most Roman governors, was thoroughly acquainted with Jewish law. Most Roman governors could care less. They were not trying on the laws of the local country. They were having their trial based upon Roman law. But Felix had married a Jewish girl named Drusilla. And because of this, he had become very familiar. That marriage to Drusilla is recorded in Acts 24:24. But his desire for corruption overrode this. But it explains why Paul was able to push a Jewish theological argument in a Roman court trying his case. Festus, on the other hand, had no knowledge of Jewish law. Festus is recorded in history as being one of the most upright of all of the Roman procurators. Certainly in the trial of Paul, as we're going to look at the case of Festus, he shows all the nobility of a judge who is there purely as a judge. He is the most objective of judges, and he embodies all true principles of correct jurisprudence in trying a case. But he was, naturally, being in a new country, eager to win over the constituency. So he had that one thing going against him, and that's recorded in the 25th chapter and the 9th verse, where it says, Festus, willing to do to the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul. He did want to win the favor of the Jewish people. And yet, when he has a trial before him, he does just the opposite. His principles of law take priority over his desire to please the Jews. Agrippa was Jewish. As a result, Agrippa was thoroughly familiar with Jewish law. Very well versed, he was of the family of Herod, and he was an individual who was a loyal Jewish man. He was loyal much more than the Herod family had been traditionally, because you recall they were Edomites. But he was a thorough proselyte, as was his wife Bernice. There was a thorough belief in the Jewish law. Therefore, Festus, who had the least Jewish connections in the whole matter, who was the least religious man in the entire cast of characters, is going to come out as the fairest and the most impartial. This is what we said at the beginning. The children of this world are often in their generation wiser than the children of light. Let's get down to our subject, Festus. The travel for Festus, the 25th chapter of the book of Acts. We're going to simplify our looking at Festus' character by noticing just two principles. These are two principles that form the basis for the entire philosophy of Festus in having this trial. His first principle, he said, no case can be rightfully heard unless both the accused and the accuser are present. Chapter 25, verse 16. To whom I answered, to the Jews, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he with his accused had the accusers face to face and had license to answer for himself concerning the crime against him. That's the first principle of Festus. I will not hear a case unless I hear both sides. And I want both sides to have the ability to cross-examine the other side. That's an important principle. The second principle of Festus, chapter 25, verse 27, is it is not proper to refer a case to another authority unless the charges be clearly established. Chapter 25, verse 27. It seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. These two principles, perhaps more than any other principles of law, assure objectivity, assure a correct and unbiased trial. If you hear both sides of a matter and let them cross-examine each other, and if you can clearly state what the charges are so you can understand the defense. Let's look at them in more detail. The right of the accused to face his accuser. Throughout Paul's trials, this is something Paul recognized was lacking in prior trials. In chapter 24, verses 18 to 20, he makes this very case. Paul is saying, certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple. Not with multitude, not with tumult. They ought to have been here before me. They ought to object if they brought against me. Or else let these same here say, if they found any evil doing in me, while I stood before the council. He says in his earlier trial, I don't acknowledge the whole procedure. You've got me here, but where are my accusers? All you've got is hearsay evidence. Unless the accusers are present, you don't have the ability for me to give a proper defense. And Paul is absolutely correct. Festus recognizes this. If they had been there, Paul could have straightened up the whole base of the charge, because the base of the charge, as we learn in 21:29, was incorrect. He didn't have any Greeks in that temple. This Trophimus that they thought he had in the temple, he could have asked them, can you swear it was Trophimus you saw me with? And if they would have to answer, well, we can't swear it was Trophimus, we know you had four in there, and we saw you with Trophimus. Where do you see me with Trophimus? Well, about outside the temple, you're walking by. Did you see me walk out of the temple with Trophimus? Well, no. Then you can't prove I was in the temple with Trophimus. But without them present, he can't make that defense because there's nobody there to answer his countercharge. He's got no way to clarify himself. The right of the accuser to be before the accused is an essential right in any kind of conduct between two dissenting parties. This is the principle of Jesus Christ in Matthew 18, that famous passage from verse 15 to 17. He did not say, if you have lied against your brother, well then proceed to talk to others about it. But go to the one you're accusing and let the accuser face the accused face to face. If you don't get satisfaction, take a witness and go to the accused and let the accuser face the accused face to face. If that's not enough, have a class trial, but let the accuser and the accused be there to face each other face to face. The whole principle is to have these two parties discussing with each other so that the true truth of the matter may come to a fore, as opposed to the apparent truth. When I was a young boy, my teen years, my early 20s, one of my abiding passions, not to my glory at all, was I was a lover of reading mystery stories. I think of every Earl Stanley Gardner that was out there, Perry Mason mystery. And basically, it was a lot of waste of time. But one thing I did appreciate. Trials that are based upon circumstantial evidence alone are capable of more than one interpretation. The right of the accuser to face the accused is an essential principle to the arriving at any point of justice. The advantages of the procedure are obvious. First, it helps you determine what was the truth of a circumstance. Not what was the apparent truth, but what was the real truth. Second, it clears up misunderstandings. Oh, I thought you were doing this. No, I wasn't doing that. Well, it sure looked that way. Sorry, but that's not what I was doing. And you can explain things that are misunderstood. Third, it reveals the bias of the accusers. Because immediately in the cross-examination, you can, by answering a certain way, show that the accuser is not interested in the truth, but is interested in proving his point. If that is true, what is true? Fourth, it examines hidden motives. Motives that may not be obvious in a straight accusation. A person gets up there and makes an accusation, sounds very righteous. But when the accused begins cross-examining, all of a sudden it becomes apparent, you've got a reason to want me out of the picture. Paul could have handled that very easily by showing their basic animosity toward the Christian sect as a whole. It's not me you're after. You want to undermine the whole Christian sect of Judaism. That was the real accused, and that hidden motive you brought out in the trial. Fifth, it acknowledges a principle we often forget. The accused may be right. Just the fact that he is accused doesn't make him wrong. My early training was in journalism. One of the first words you learn in being trained in journalism is the little word alleged. You see that a lot in papers. The alleged criminal. This person alleges this. And all that word is a nice safety bell for the journalist. All that word means is, we don't know if it's true or not, but he's been accused. It's been stated of such and such. Well, that's what this is recognizing, that there are alleged truths that may be falsehoods. This is why the principle should always be there in any hearing of no admittance of hearsay evidence. One of the best examples of this principle being followed, other than Festus, was by another Gentile. Back in the Old Testament, a young Gentile, a young man by the name of Elihu. He was there at the trial of Job. That's what he was. Job was on trial before these three, quote, comforters, unquote. But Elihu wasn't one of the three. He was a bystander, a listener. And when Elihu gets involved in the argument with Job, and he finds Job guilty, but when he gets involved in the argument, in Job 33:8, he states one of his principles. If you can answer me, set your words in order and stand up. Always, it's a principle of accusation to recognize my accusation is based upon either hearsay or observation. Either of these are potentially open to a second interpretation. So this is what appears to me. But Job, if you've got an answer, I invite your answer. And that must be important to us. But here, like in so many places, that observation of Jesus is true. The children of this world are, in their generation, often wiser than the children of light. Have you ever judged by hearsay evidence? Have I ever judged by hearsay evidence? Have we ever heard such and such and so about brother or sister and such and such? Well, I don't fully believe. I can see where that person could do it. Yeah. And you go to look over and your whole attitude toward brother or sister and so changes. Have any of us ever failed to listen to both sides of an argument? Have we heard part of an argument? Brother so-and-so believes so-and-so. I heard it myself on the platform. Have you ever then gone to the brother and say, what is your beliefs of such and such? Not, did you say such and such? But what are your beliefs of such and such? Let them explain thoroughly what they think. Get the other side of the coin. The wise man puts it very well in Proverbs 18:13. He who judges a matter before he hears it, it is folly unto him. That the necessity is there, if we want to be Festuses in trying a matter, to hear both sides thoroughly, to be sure that we're not hearing just the words, but the thoughts and the concepts behind the words. Do we look, when we have a disagreement of either thought or action with one of our brethren, do we look for an alternative explanation to why the difference may be there? Extenuating circumstances. You know, let's take just beliefs for a second. Do we realize how thoroughly what we believe is determined by our environment? You know, frequently, if we grew up with a certain environment that believes a certain thing, we may not have thoroughly studied the matter, but it certainly sounds reasonable what we've heard and believe. We say, yes, this is the group I feel comfortable with. I believe this. And we hear the opposite viewpoint, and we say, well, I certainly don't believe that. But maybe we never studied it. Maybe we never heard the other side of the coin. Maybe we never looked at the whole picture. Maybe we never talked to somebody who had the other. Because what we're framed with is the extenuating circumstances of where we grew up, our class environment, or the conventions we attend, or whatever. Same thing in actions. We may have friends that do certain things, and it forms what is called peer pressure. These are extenuating circumstances that need to be considered. Do we seek a full and complete explanation, as Festus sought? Are we satisfied with the peripheral discussion? Enough to satisfy, yes, I like this point more than this point. I like this person's behavior more than this person's, whatever it might be. These are ways in which, if we don't, we fall guilty of that accusation, and the Festuses of this world are wiser than their generation, than the children of light. Let's look to the second principle, Festus. 25:27. It seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Now that seems so odd. How could a judge, after a trial, and this is after the trial, the whole situation before Festus and Agrippa in Festus' hearing have underway, Festus, I don't know how to handle this case, I don't understand the trial. Because Festus could not understand the trial. The charges against Paul were religious charges. He was being tried on theological grounds. He was being tried in the case of heresy, and heresy was not a crime in Roman courts. So Festus said, I can't send him to Rome on a charge of heresy. We don't have such a charge. But I got to send him to Rome because Paul is appealing to Rome. Well, Paul, you're confusing the whole issue. Why don't you just let yourself be heard before the Sanhedrin? And Paul is saying the same thing a lot of criminals, not that Paul's a criminal, the same thing a lot of criminals say. I cannot get a fair hearing in this court. I need a change of venue. That's what Paul is saying. He said, there's no way the Jews, who are already pre-made up that the Christian sect is wrong, will hear the theological charge against me. I appeal to the only possible objective court I have, the court of Rome. The charge against me is I've broken down the middle wall of partition. But I refuse that charge. I say to hear me before Rome. Now Felix, his wife Drusilla, Agrippa and his wife Bernice, they had some comprehension of the trial. But Felix did not. Festus did not. Festus did not understand this. He was not acquainted with Jewish theology. He was there as a Roman judge of jurisprudence. And so Festus said, the simple answer is, will you go to Jerusalem and be tried there? I want to please the Jews. And besides, I don't understand a thing about this. I don't know what's going on in this trial. I would like to be like Pilate before me, just wash my hands of the whole matter. But that's really the attitude that Festus takes. But Paul says, no, I will not go there. I'm a Roman citizen. I appeal to Rome. He refuses his government in Jerusalem. He appeals to Rome. And now Festus has got a catch-22 situation. I've got to send him to Rome, but I got no crime. I've got nothing to send him on. What can I do? That's the point of Acts 25:27. That's why he caused Agrippa to hear the case. He said, Agrippa, maybe you can understand what's going on here. And that's why Agrippa and Festus have such different actions and reactions. Paul makes a brilliant defense of the resurrection of the dead, and Festus says, Paul, much learning has made you mad. He said, I don't understand a thing you're saying. This is totally outside of the jurisdiction of the courtroom. But Agrippa's reaction, Paul, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. I understand exactly what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. And then Paul says, oh, I wish you would become one. But Agrippa's not about to do that. Festus is more confused than ever. Agrippa, comprehending it, doesn't know how to handle it either. So the understanding of the charge was essential, and that was something that was never resolved in the case of Paul. Maybe that's one reason he was just held in house arrest. But he had no clear charge. He was not a criminal by Roman law. On the other hand, he was a threat to the Roman rule in Judea. How often again, the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light. Are we as thorough in investigating matters of difference as was the pagan judge Festus? Do we investigate not only the crime, that's what Matthew 18 is about, do we also take the time to investigate what is the scriptural position? That seems odd, but we do need to investigate that. Differences of opinion, differences of action, usually are based upon differences of interpretation as to what the scriptures teach. Do we check the context? Do we seek for contradictory evidence? I have a certain amount of medical problems, and one of the things I rather enjoy when I get a change of medication is to read these long little things they put in the medical bottles. And one of the things I always appreciate, there is something called contraindications. In other words, this medicine should do this, this, and this, but it may do this, this, and this, and therefore watch out. A lot of life needs an examination of contraindications. It's easy enough to build up a body of evidence for this action or this opinion, but do we look for any evidence that contradicts that action or contradicts that opinion? Do we look for a true harmonization of all? Do we really compare, when we compare scripture, apples with apples, or do we compare apples with oranges? So now Matthew 19 and 1 Corinthians 5 is an example. Do we carefully differentiate between an act and a habit, between a slip and a sin, between a tendency and an action, between a current situation and something that happened in the past? Do we look for all of these evidences in understanding the crime and its cause? Do we allow for, what's that word they use in law? X something circumstances. Doesn't hit my mind now. But anyway, extenuating circumstances. The human weaknesses, the human pressures that cause certain actions. On doctrinal issues, do we examine the whole of scriptural evidence, or do we seek for those texts that support us? I remember once sitting with a brother in a discourse, and after I said, "What'd you think of that talk?" And he said, "Well, it looked to me like the speaker got a good thought in his mind and looked for what scriptures you could find to back it up." And sometimes that's true with all of us. I find it true with myself. I don't find that as an accusation against others. You feel something strongly and you try to form a talk by finding those texts that support that. But do we really look for all the texts, even those that don't support it? Do we look for the contraindications? Do we dig into the words behind the concepts? You know, there's probably no more controversial issue today among Bible students than the times of restitution. But do we look for the concepts behind the words? So often we find we mean the same thing and use different expressions. Do we try stating our viewpoint in the words of the opposite, a person who holds the opposite viewpoint? Do we seek to carefully define the exact difference and not the obvious difference? What is the precise difference between the views that we're holding? The principle once laid down, I think it embodies this whole point of Festus. You never fully comprehend another person's viewpoint until you can state that person's viewpoint back to him in your own words in a way that he can agree with.